discussion of frequently asked question number 60. The question is, what is our benevolent role? And you may remember that we have emphasized the distinction between the role that the local congregation has in the realm of benevolence and the role that an individual has. We might establish God's will in that area. We've sought to define what benevolence is, and indicated from that it had reference to helping individuals physically or meeting physical needs. The example we gave in Acts 11 is a good example of that. The brethren in Judea were in the midst of a famine in need of relief, and so brethren determined to send money, send means by which they could purchase food and obtain that relief. There are other passages which teach that same principle. We'll talk a little bit more about James chapter 1 and verse 27, where we are told that the practice of pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is visiting the fatherless and widows in their affliction and keeping oneself unspotted from the world. So visiting the fatherless and widows, the word visiting specifically has reference to caring for their needs as well. The idea there is not just going and shooting breeds, but taking care of those who are in need, fulfilling their needs. Galatians 6, there are passages which teach the same. So we'll look at a number of those passages actually as we continue in our study. But also to try in our lesson to establish the importance of the work. While we do acknowledge that the spiritual work of evangelism and perhaps the spiritual work of edification as being greater works because they're concerned with the state of the soul and benefiting the soul, in other words, saving men for an eternity. Generosity, the expression of love, a willing and generous heart is something that is extremely important for anyone who would call themselves Christians. You cannot truly be just in claiming to be a follower of God if you do not have love for your fellow man. And so if there is not a heart of compassion, a desire to help others when you have opportunity, then there is something that is amiss, something that is wrong in the Christian's life. And so as we seek to differentiate, we seek to establish what our role is and how to accomplish our role, and what our limitations might be as we act collectively as a congregation, what our responsibilities are individually. We don't want in any way to leave the impression that we're trying to minimize the importance of the work itself. It's an extremely important work. It's something that God expects of us. And there are plenty of passages to establish that. We talked about the example of the Good Samaritan and how Jesus actually contrasted this individual. By the way, you remember that Samaritans were not highly respected in the first century by the Jews. They were half-breeds. They were reviled as a group. But he contrasted a Samaritan who had a good heart and a willingness to be benevolent with a priest and a Levite, two individuals that were considered very religious and would be well-respected in Jewish society. Those individuals were unwilling to help an individual who had fallen into need. They turned away and walked by on the other side, willing to do what it was their responsibility to do, where the Samaritan, who was, again, one reviled by most, was willing to do what was necessary. And when you look at his example, he went, it seems, almost above and beyond. I mean, he was very generous with regard to what he did for this man. And so Jesus contrasted that Samaritan with those religious individuals, showing what God expects of us. So we need to make sure that we fulfill our responsibilities. We don't need to be hiding behind any rationale that would excuse us from those responsibilities. You'll remember the Jews were admonished by Jesus on one occasion because he indicated their responsibility to care for their parents, and their answer was, as a result of rabbinic tradition, that, well, you know, I would take care of my parents, but instead I've given that money to the temple, and as if that would relieve them of the responsibility to care for their parents. And he admonished them for that ungodliness and that they were not caring for their own. So we need to be careful that we say, you know, we not say, well, you know, I've we're doing it this way so I don't have a personal responsibility, or I've got some technicality or some loophole where I can get out of my responsibility. And of course, that's not the purpose of any of this. It's simply to establish clearly what God does require and how He requires, the pattern that He has established with regard to the support of individuals who are indigent or who have perhaps a chronic circumstance, such as the widows that we mentioned from 1 Timothy 5, other things like that. So we talked about that quite a bit, actually, from the article itself. We answered the first three questions on the worksheet last week before we ended, we ran out of time. We talked about some of the Old Testament passages, which indicated clearly the fact that God has always expected His people, even under the Old Covenant with regard to the Jews, to be compassionate and care for their own. The second question, we talked a little bit about the responsibility that that Jesus taught in His Sermon on the Mount concerning the willingness to lend to those who ask and to be desirous of sharing and doing good for others, as found in Hebrews chapter 13. The third question, I've got it up on the board here. You'll remember we kind of rushed through that at the very end. I'm not saying that we need to discuss it further, but I did want to just remind you of it. The question was, what are some bad motivations for turning people away who seek our financial aid? The reason he asked this question is because there are certain times in the New Testament where instructions are given to people to turn away those who ask for help. And you would maybe think, because of the compassion that God instructs us to have, because God Himself is compassionate, that it wouldn't matter, whatever the circumstance is, that if individuals ask for our help, that we should automatically give that help. But in fact, there are at least a couple of occasions in Scripture to where instructions are given to not give them help, that it would be inappropriate to give them help. We've already talked about one. It's not really the emphasis I want to place on this, but I will remind you of that text in 1 Timothy 5 with regard to the young widows and the fact that if they were put on the roll, which would be an ongoing support of them as young widows, that that would be something that would lead them into sinful practice, to wax wanton against Christ. And as a result of that, he told them that the young widows are supposed to marry and that they're not to be put on the roll as an older widow might be. So there is an example of, we think, well, you know, this is a young widow, she's in need, so let's support her from the church. And while it may be for a portion of time because of indigence that we could offer up some support, to put her on the roll, which is an indication of ongoing, open-ended support, that's not something that we should do. Because of the problems that would come as a result of it. And so some instructions are given there not to offer that support. Having said that, there are a number of motivations or reasons why individuals would refuse to give support that are illegitimate, that are not acceptable. We talked about a few in answering this question. Individual who, because he himself is greedy or covetous, might refuse to help another. You'll remember that Judas Iscariot, who had the purse, he was the treasurer of the little group that followed after Jesus, the disciples, that he was critical of a woman who broke an expensive flask, an alabaster flask of ointment to anoint Christ. And his statement was that that money, that thing could have been sold, and the money could have been given to the poor, but of course, the inspired historian reveals that he said it because he was a covetous individual, because he had the purse, and he coveted that money. Later on, of course, he covenanted with the Jewish leaders to betray his Lord for 30 pieces of silver. So that's kind of an indication of his mindset. Greed and avarice is something that certainly might would preclude our giving to someone else. I'm not going to give to someone else because I'm stingy, because I desire the money myself, because of some covetousness that might be existent. We also mentioned that apathy, just lack of care, lack of love, maybe anxiousness. An individual is unwilling to give because he's afraid that if he gives something that later on he might not have what he needs. Selfishness, those are kinds of things that we that we want to be sure that, that we are not guilty of. Those are not good reasons for refusing to help someone. But there are some legitimate reasons for refusing to help, and we'll make note of those as we continue on in the discussion. So those, that gets us kind of where we are up to this point in time in question number four, and ask if anybody have any questions, comments before we get into the next question. Okay, let's go. And question number four, and I would like you to turn with me to Romans, the 12th chapter, if you will. And the text in Romans chapter 12, beginning with verse 3, is indicating the importance with regard to those who have received spiritual gifts, specifically in verse 6, prophecy, ministry, teaching, exhortation, all of these things. Some of them, of course, could have reference to spiritual gifts, but there are others here within this context that would have application today as well. And the emphasis in this particular section is that we need to be good stewards of the gift that we receive, and generous with regard to that gift and sharing it with others. And as a part of that, in verse 8, you'll notice that he who exhorts in exhortation, he who gives with liberality, he who leads with diligence, he who shows mercy with cheerfulness. So in the midst of that is that call for him who leads to, him who gives, to give with liberality. He continues on in verse 9 and says, "Let love be without hypocrisy, abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love." Now, all of these things have reference to the responsibility, whether it be the gifts that are under consideration or these further exhortations beginning in verse 9. All of them have to do with our interaction with, our behavior towards towards a brother or a sister, and the response that we should give to those that we love in faith. So he says, be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. Honor, give preference to one another. Not lacking in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord. Rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation. Continuing steadfastly in prayer. And then notice in verse 13 of the text, distributing to the needs of the saints. And then given to hospitality. So all of these things are things where you help in sharing with others. You're to be quick to do so. You're to be generous in regard to these things. So looking at the question, it specifies how individual members of the body interact with one another, touches on various situations that might require the giving of alms or the offering of these physical gifts. We mentioned that in verse 8 as well as verse 13. As members of one another, how should we give or share and distribute to the needy saints? What are the characteristics of these exhortations? What comes to mind as we look at these things in the context of verses Romans 12, verses 13? Well, I'll answer it once, but somebody please do. Give me some. Anybody? Yes, John. Thank you.
Emphasizes the liberality and also cheerfulness that goes along with mercy. So give with your ability and give gladly to show mercy and help to the needy.
Very good. Very good. That's true. Anything else? Yes?
When giving in this manner, it does eventually lead to a very, I would say, cheerful and glad heart.
I think we understand that concept that giving to other people is something that causes us joy, it causes us happiness. It's something very, very gratifying about when you offer to help someone who has a need and you feel that need and they benefit from it, they're thankful, they're relieved, the stress is lessened because of the help that you've been able to give, and that's something that is joyful. It's something we try to teach our children with regard to the giving of gifts. It's better to give than to receive. Children don't understand that early on because they enjoy getting stuff. But the greater joy is the joy that is experienced when you see someone else benefit, appreciate, receive something that you have given them. And so that's a very good point. That is an indication of a loving heart. Why is it that I enjoy giving to someone and seeing their face light up or seeing the benefit that comes from it? Because I have a care for them, I have a concern for them. So the motivation in all of that is love, which is why there are sometimes circumstances where an individual will give, and he'll give grudgingly. He'll give of necessity. He gives because it's required of him. It's not because that love is present in his heart. And that's why when God says he wants you to give cheerfully and generously, because it's not enough simply to give out of obligation. God wants our motivation and our desire to be a lover man, which is what leads to this cheerful attitude and expression with regard to giving and gladness of heart as others receive those things. So those are all good things to point out in regard to this. It's also an indication of selflessness. That's the other point that I had here. Selfless love, sharing liberally. And by the way, again, the emphasis you'll notice in verse 13 is the distribution to the saints. So there is a preference that is given here to brethren. Of course, that's the context here, so that's understandable. But I think there is a special responsibility and duty with regard to being benevolent and helpful to those who are in need among your brethren. Yes?
Yeah, sometimes we forget the fact that our ability to give and share with others comes from God. God's given this to us, given us the ability. And we aren't doing this on our own. God has given us the ability to give.
That's a good point. In Jesus' prayer that he taught his disciples, or he taught them how to pray in the prayer in Matthew chapter 6, there's that statement, "Give us this day our daily bread." And I've told y'all this story before, but there's, I forget now the name of the show, Jimmy Stewart's in it, about the Old South. And he sat at the head of the table and he prays to God because his dearly departed wife wanted him to raise them as Christians. And he prayed to God, and he thanked him for all that they had received, even though they're the ones that work for it, and they're the ones that deal the field, and they're the ones that did this, that, and the other. But thank you anyway, Lord. Well, I'm afraid sometimes that Christians kind of have that attitude. You know, we might go through the motions of saying the words, "Give us this day our daily bread," but we think that all of the things that we receive, we receive by the efforts of our hands, and as such, God didn't have anything to do with it, when in reality, all that we receive is indeed from Him. And so, as we do contemplate helping others, we do acknowledge the fact that it is because of God's grace and mercy and His blessings to be shown to us that we have the wherewithal and ability to help in those circumstances. And it's simply a matter of stewardship and something we should gladly render to others. Good one. Yes, Justin?
I want to point out that this passage never talks about money. And money is really one of the least important things that God gives us. When it talks about visiting the fatherless and the widows, there's a reason you got to go visit them. You can't just send money for somebody to go take care of them in your stead. There's a reason when he talks about the gifts that you have, he doesn't list money. He lists service, and he lists teaching. Those are much greater gifts. Those are much better things. And contributing to the needs of the saints, you could do that via money, but when Jesus talks about it, he says, "I was naked, and you gave me clothes. I was hungry, and you gave me food." Not, "I was naked, and you gave me money, and said, get out of here." And I think that's important to realize.
Yeah, certainly. You know, it's we're living in a different system in our daytime economy and such, the way in which it's done. And we do need to, well, again, this is something we recognize. An older generation sometimes expresses displeasure at the fact that gift giving has come down to gift cards or little envelopes with cash in it, instead of the actual thoughtfulness of considering a gift, taking the time to have a perspective and have a desire to give someone a specific item, going out and purchasing it and delivering that. And there's more thought that's given to that, and it's a special thing. And there is an aspect to that that is more personal. It's a greater expression of love. It It expresses more of an intimacy with regard to relationship than cold hard cash could ever do. And I think that that's kind of an important thing for us to consider because of where we have gone. I mean, just because modern society, you have ATM cards and ready access to dollar bills and things like that, that sometimes, if this situation with the tornadoes and such comes up and, the actual physical bearing of sustenance, of gifts and of clothing and those kinds of things can be a very touching thing, very helpful, not only for the physical needs, but also the spiritual welfare and the mind of an individual during those times of difficulty. So, very, very important point to make and legitimate. Yes, sir?
I have just one comment. And when you are, for charity's sake, giving of your time or your talents, you are emulating the one that we worship.
That's right. Very good. Because that's certainly what Jesus did, giving himself completely for us. Good point. Okay, anybody else will go on? Yes, sir?
Well, as you started out there about the Jews had the tradition, they didn't get their parents and they used a loophole. But there are scriptures that give us excuse when at times that's not to be used as a loophole, like in 2 Corinthians 8, verse 12. For if there is first a loving mind, it is accepted according to what one has and not according to what he does not have. So if we don't have it, then we're not expected to give. And it goes on verse 13, for I do not mean that others should be eased, that you be burdened, but by equality, that now at this time your abundance may supply their lack, that their abundance may surely supply the lack, then we get equality. So there are times we always can't give. And then Paul wrote to also the Philippians in 4:10, but I rejoice in the Lord greatly that now at last your care for me has flourished again. But though you surely did care, but you lacked opportunity. So sometimes we don't have the opportunity, or we don't have the funds to get. But I say they're not to use as loopholes like the Jews did in that time.
Well, yeah, there's kind of a dynamic balance that's in place here. When you have someone who has an opportunity to give and to practice benevolence, then it's understood in that situation that the one to whom they are rendering that benevolence themselves do not have that ability. not always the case. So I am reminded of the Macedonians who gave even out of their poverty, given abundantly, which indicated a mindset that they had to where they weren't going to use that as an excuse. They didn't have much, but they were very generous with the little that they did have in helping the needs of those who are indigent.
I had that down as one of the exceptions.
Yeah. But in that regard, yeah, I mean, that, again, what does God expect of us? God expects that we do what we can do. The standard is not where, well, if you can't do it, you're going to lose your soul because this is a standard right here and you're not up there, and you, even if it's physically impossible for you to do it, it doesn't matter. It's not, God's not that kind of God. But again, what our emphasis, I think, should be is with regard to generosity and the responsibility we have to be benevolent to those in need. And by the way, we need to be gracious with regard to the receiving of gifts as well. And from time to time, it is necessary for us to receive such gifts. And there are actually a number of verses which deal with that as well. But looking at it from the point of view that we are, there is that call for us to be, out of a selfless love, willing to share liberally to those who are in need, whether it be monetarily or with other, with our efforts, with our time, with our talents, whatever the case may be, fulfill whatever need they might have. And the special, verse 13, the special indication to the care for saints that is mentioned there in that text, distributing to the needs of the saints. Okay, question number five takes us to James chapter 1 and verse 27, if you want to turn there. I quoted it earlier in our study. And again, I do not want to belabor the point because it's not the emphasis of the text. You know, it's something that is it's an unfortunate but necessary thing. Maybe not every time, but that we do touch on things as a result of a response to error that is taught. In other words, if the institutional issues, the institutional error had never propped up, James chapter 1 had never been used inappropriately to as a proof text to justify an ungodly practice, then we wouldn't have to make a point concerning the distinction between what is individual and collective effort. But we do want to emphasize, again, as we note, that there are a couple of passages that are commonly turned to by the institutional churches that say that we should send money out of the church treasury to orphans homes or other kinds of benevolent societies. And they'll say that that's the practice of pure and undefiled religion. How in the world could you be against or think that it's unscriptural for us to send money out of the church treasury to this home when James very clearly says that the practice of pure and undefiled religion is the visitation of orphans? How in the world could that be? Now, we've already made the emphasis in our study in 1 Timothy chapter 5 that there is a distinction made between what is individual and what is collective action. So we just make note of that again as we read that text in verse 27. The practice of pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father, is this: to visit orphans or the fatherless, the widows in their trouble, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Now, I have done this just so that these questions can be answered very, very easily. I want you to know, beginning back up in verse 23, the statement, if anyone is a hearer of the word, not a doer. It's talking about an individual. It's not talking about church. Not if any church is a hearer of the word, not a doer, but anyone is an individual. Because that individual, verse 24, he observes himself. Verse 25, but he who looks into the perfect law of liberty, the latter part of the verse, this one will be blessed in what he does. And then in verse 26, if any one among you thinks he is religious, doesn't bridle his tongue but deceives his heart, this one's religion is useless. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: to visit the orphans and widows in their trouble and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. So it's very clear. The context is obvious that this is referencing what I as an individual have a responsibility to do in my service to God. And it's the individual's responsibility in this case to visit the orphans and the widows. So that would be inclusive. That gives me not only authority, but obligation. And I think that's the way we need to look at it, to be honest. Because we've been talking so much about the limited authority that we have with regard to the collective work of the congregation in the realm of benevolence. And that's why in these discussions that have been ongoing over the last 40, 50 years, the charge is levied against us who believe this way, that, well, you guys don't believe in caring for people, or you are uncaring. It's obvious. All you're talking about is what we can't do with regard to these things. What this basically does is give a very broad authority for us, mandate for us to be benevolent with regard to our actions, helpful. When we see individuals who are in need, to take care of the needs that we see. This is the practice of pure religion. This is perhaps one of the best personifications of the command of love that can be illustrated. Here we have an individual, we have a care and concern for the person, we act in their best interest. That's pure religion. That's the way God expects us to think as Christians. And so it's a very broad mandate. So it not only authorizes us to help people who aren't Christians, but it gives us a responsibility to be helpful to those that we can help, no matter who they might be. And then you make that distinction. So when we talk about the realm of benevolence, we do not, again, as we said at the beginning of our time, we do not want any way to have people think that we are against helping people. It's simply that God gives a very limited focus with regard to the collective work of the congregation in the realm of benevolence, because the work of the church is spiritual in nature. But God gives a very broad mandate and responsibility to us as individual Christians to help whoever it is that we come into contact with who are in need. And these categories here, the orphans and the widows. Now, in our time, there may be some governmental help and other agencies and things where they can get some support, get some relief. Back then, those things weren't present. So you have an orphan, it's a little child that doesn't have parents. How is he going to live? He's going to be completely dependent upon someone else helping, offering the food, offering the shelter. Same way with the widow. Widows did not have the ability to make money on their own and to work and support themselves. They were wholly dependent upon others in that situation. So you're a Christian, you come along, you see it, you take care of it. That's what that visitation indicates there in the text, but it's an individual responsibility. Yes, sir.
The whole argument in this passage versus collecting money into a church treasury and sending it to an orphan is moot from the outset. It has nothing to do with singular or collective pronouns. It has to do with the fact that if we collected money in the treasury and sent it to an orphan home, or if we just all went home individually and wrote checks and sent it to an orphan home, we still haven't fulfilled this passage. And it goes back to what I was saying before. People just think money is more important than it is. You go to a nursing home and you bring some food, and those people will set the food on a table and ignore it and talk to you for 3 hours about anything. That's the most important thing you can do.
Yeah, and that's very legitimate. The problem is that argument is made, and that's the argument that's made with regard to the authority for the practice that became institutionalized typical among churches. And it's an argument in the various debates that you can read about, and if you some of you are old enough to maybe have gone to some of those debates when the institutional issues that the gospel preachers often would make is that you say that churches can do this, that's the work of benevolence. If you put a check in the contribution plate and money is sent, you haven't done any benevolent work at all yourself. That's not what James 1 is talking about. It's individuals doing the work. And so we need to recognize that it's not legitimate to make that claim in that regard. But again, the emphasis that we want to make from the text of James 1:27 is as Justin indicated, and I think that's really the final aspect of that. What do you think James means by that visit? It's that personal touch and caring for and fulfilling what needs they might have. All right, anybody else have that question? Yes, Dick?
Well, you talk about those lessons there when that first started, the debates and everything. I remember that you'd come up there, and a lot of it was done in periodicals. But anyway, that you took a look over you and helping off and sending the orphans home, brave dude. And so it said that X amount of dollars are sending. When they divided by the number of members, worked out about 12 cents. I remember that was one of the things that the non-institutional control, look how it makes as individuals.
Right. It's something that is a bit troublesome, that an individual's conscience, and not saying that all are doing that, because there are many, I'm sure, who are very very generous with regard to helping individuals in helping individually as well as a practice of their individual faith. But for an individual to have his conscience assuaged by his contribution on the first day of the week because the church is doing a work of benevolence and he's fulfilling his personal responsibility is, as I alluded to earlier, parallel to the Jew who basically said, I don't have that responsibility to personally take care of my parents because I'm sending money to the temple. And it's one of those things to where it's a way of getting out from under the responsibility, the personal aspect, that face-to-face part of what benevolence ought to be. And it's It's a shame. And that's one of the real problems with institutionalism. It's the same exact thing with regard to the American Missionary Society. I mean, why should I go out and preach when I can send my check to the American Missionary Society? They preach for me. So it's kind of preaching by proxy. It's edification by proxy. It's benevolence by proxy. And you can say the same thing. I mean, if parents say, okay, you know, I've given the responsibility to educate my children, bring them up and nurture them in the mission board, so I'm going to make sure that they're there every Sunday for the Bible class teacher to teach. Well, then you're not edifying them. The Bible class teacher is doing what they can do, but your responsibility is by edifying them, bring them up and nurture them in the mission board yourself. You can't do it by proxy. You've got to do it yourself. All of these are personal responsibilities that we have, and we need to be very generous and willing to do so. Okay? Next question. Question number 6. What is true of the Christian who refuses to share or extend benevolence? That's a very good question, because we want to talk about those who might, because of grief, sinfulness, apathy, worry, selfishness, might not do what they should do. In just the next chapter along, James chapter 2, want to read in that text verses 14 through 17. Someone like to read that for me?
What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving them the things needed for the body, what good is that? So also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead.
Now we do want to acknowledge the fact that benevolence isn't the topic under consideration in this particular passage. The topic under consideration is faith. But an example is given here. So with that example, and the example, in order for the point that he's making to be valid, the example has to be apropos. It has to be as it should be. So what is true of a Christian who would not work for benevolence? What is it an indication? Can't talk tonight. What is it an indication of? When you say the poverty, warm, and filled, but do not give them what is needed.
That's
more of a son belief.
Okay, well, it's lacking in faith, so because of our responsibility, we've just been called the previous chapter to practice that pure and undefiled religion. Yes, Connor?
I think one word that encompasses it, disingenuous.
Well, okay, so there's a hypocrisy there then in that. If you're saying go away and be warm and filled, but you're not going to help them, then that's kind of hypocritical. I want you to be fed, but I'm not willing to feed you. I want you to be clothed, but I'm not willing. So there's that indifference, that lack of care and concern, that apathy that is there. But it's certainly something that, within the context of this passage, as it's describing, a faith that is bereft of obedience is something that clearly indicates that kind of activity, an unwillingness to do what you can do, is indicative of the dead faith, a faith that is not active and acceptable to God. So it does, I think, teach us a principle here.
He's comparing a dead faith to a dead love. An expressed love that has no action is a dead love.
Very good. Very good. Very good parallel. Yes, Jerry?
Taking a little different approach to it, looking at many times in organizations such as United Fund and Salvation Army, all these things are, you know, benevolent. You have to go deeper into the why of what you are giving to. I know that, for example, Salvation Army is really a branch of the Methodist Church. I mean, I'm giving them that church. I was also on the committee to determine what was given to the United Fund. Well, they have determined ahead of time what percentage was going to give to any organization. A lot of those organizations, I did not believe it. So I refused to give to the organization. I think you have to also look at that. My situation always been to give to the church and those to the church, and then I'm sort of saved.
Yeah, and that's something I think maybe we can touch on a little bit in the next question when we're talking about reasons why you shouldn't give. It's not the primary point of that, but there are legitimate scriptural objections that might be raised to many charitable organizations. And it's the same problem that we've talked about many times with regard to a religious expression today. Individuals say, "Lord, Lord." They call upon the name of the Lord, but they do not do the things that He says. And so when individuals are laying claim that what they're doing is a good work, and as it is a good work, it's something that that we should take part in. In fact, I got a call just yesterday, in the office from a charitable organization. It was a quote ministry. It was a religious organization that we would have problems with regard to their doctrinal teachings and all. But they have some benevolent activities, and that's the spiel that was given to me. And I thought to myself, as she was giving me this spiel, that I could just turn it around on her. So she's saying, you know, we're doing this, and this for folks, and we need your help. Would you give us money? And I could say to her, well, we're doing this, and this for folks. Could you give us some money? You know, and I'm thinking to myself, why are they calling a church for the church to send money to them? It's just kind of a peculiar type of situation, but it happens quite often. But the fact is, I told her we wouldn't participate in that work because they were practicing things that weren't scriptural and held the doctrine that we don't hold to and all of those kinds of things. That's separate aside from the fact that the church doesn't have the authority to give money to those kinds of organizations, as we've already talked about. The same thing can be said with regard to an individual. Yes, I am supposed to be benevolent and charitable, but do I have the right to send money to an organization that teaches error, that could condemn souls just because they do some good things as well? And the Salvation Army is a good example of that. You're throwing your money in the pot during the Christmas time. What is that money used for? Well, a portion of it, maybe a large portion of it, used to buy clothes so that people can be fed. And I know a lot of people have some real problems with the way the Salvation Army does some of those kinds of things. But yes, they're very socially active, very benevolent society. But they also teach false doctrine with regard to what man must do to be saved. And you're sending money to an organization that is going to condemn souls to hell by the preaching of a false gospel. And I recognize that maybe some Christians have in the past done that out of ignorance, but you need to think about those things. When you're driving down the street and the fireman holds a baboon, well, that's a fireman, that's a secular deal, you want to get money, fine. But you've got a religious organization dressed all in white, and they want you to give money to them for some religious work, and they teach error, you ought not to have anything to do with that. Because you're propagating the error. Gene, no, okay, I'm sorry. Okay, a little long-winded there, but we're going to stop here, and we will pick up, be able to finish, and we'll have the next set up in fact, the time. But we're going to pick up with 1 John 3:16-17, question number 6.